The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. U.S. citizens imprisoned abroad often become causes. Their families and citizens groups lobby for leniency. U.S. government officials work to free them, or failing that, ensure that they receive due process, be treated fairly in court, and if convicted, that the punishment they receive fits the crime. When foreign nationals commit a crime in the U.S., their consulates work to avoid what the vast majority of U.N. member states consider to be barbaric. Execution. A Mexican government program has paid millions of dollars to American lawyers for tracking and assisting Mexican nationals charged in death penalty cases here in the U.S. The Marshall Project's Maurice Chama wrote about the Mexican Capital Legal Assistance Program. And Maurice, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How long has this program been funded by Mexico's government?
It's been funded since the year 2000, but it has a history that goes before that. There's sort of a long tradition of Mexico putting in money to train lawyers, American lawyers, who are defending Mexican nationals who are facing the death penalty.
What kind of help do nationals fighting the death penalty get here in the U.S. with this program?
So when someone's charged and is potentially facing the death penalty after they've committed murder or allegedly committed it, an attorney will be appointed by the court, and then there is a sort of network of American lawyers who are on this payroll from the Mexican government who keep track of these cases. They swoop in, they call up the attorneys who have been appointed, and they offer all sorts of help, money for trainings. Oftentimes, early on in a death penalty case, a sort of crucial element is research on the background and the upbringing of the person who's facing the death penalty. The idea is that if you get more evidence that that person had a very tough upbringing, that there are sort of reasons to grant them mercy, that evidence can be very powerful to prosecutors and juries. And so getting it early is important, and it can often be hard to get if the person grew up in Mexico and you're talking about going maybe to a small town where accessibility is an issue, language is an issue for these American lawyers. So the Mexican program trains them on how to look for this evidence and then helps sort of clear the way for them to travel in Mexico and get this kind of evidence. Mitigation evidence is what it's called.
You write in part about illustrating this program with Angel Campos Nava, a man who was charged with killing his wife, Leslie Hope Plott, I think, in Alabama. So
that's right.
Run us through that case.
So it was sort of interesting that it took place in Alabama, which is famous for having particularly harsh anti-immigration laws. It's the state of Jeff Sessions, who is one of Trump's most outspoken supporters. But in early 2013, 25-year-old Leslie Hope Plott was murdered and caught on camera was her estranged husband, Angel Campos Nava, who had come to the U.S. illegally many years before, had several domestic violence charges against the victim. And, you know, his guilt was not so much in doubt. The real question was over whether or not he would face the death penalty. And pretty soon after his lawyer, a woman named Rebecca Thomason, was appointed, she was contacted by the Mexican Capital Legal Assistance Program and basically offered all sorts of help in Mr. Nava's defense, including travel to Mexico, travel to trainings around the country. And it was at one of these trainings that she met actually an American anthropologist who was living in Cuernavaca, a man named Charlie Goff. And together they went down to this tiny little town in Mexico where Mr. Nava had been born and raised and came back up with all kinds of evidence about how he had been beaten as a child, how he had been raised in sort of atrocious poverty, a kind of poverty that would be, you know, very difficult for a lot of Americans to imagine. All of this evidence together helped sway the prosecutor, the district attorney in their county in Alabama, to back down and to allow Mr. Nava to plead for a life sentence. And it is hard to imagine that Ms. Thomason, you know, Nava's attorney, would have been able to get all that evidence and sway him without, you know, that money and assistance from the Mexican government.
Was she a public defender?
She was, yes.
And that's probably the case for a lot of these people who are illegal immigrants in the United States, I imagine.
Yeah, precisely. A lot of them are not going to have the money to pay for their own attorney. So they're going to be sort of placed with whatever public defender or court-appointed attorney will handle their case. And the quality of that attorney can range all over the map, depending on what state and what county you're in. So this, you know, influx of money is basically like the equivalent of being able to hire a really good lawyer.
So how much money is the Mexican government spending on these cases?
I looked at government records. You know, the program has to file different kinds of documents with the Department of Justice because it's a foreign government participating in our legal system. And the budget shows that it's been, you know, between $3.5 million to a little bit more than $4 million a year. There was one document that showed a list of cases and the number of cases they were looking at in a given year, and it was about 135 cases. So when you just break that out, you're talking about between $20,000 and $30,000 per year per case. And when you compare that to the fact that in some states the amount of money that defenders can be paid is $1,000 or significantly less, you can see how this money starts to sort of shape the outcome.
$1,000 in a death penalty case?
Yeah, in some states, in Alabama, the Equal Justice Initiative, which is a nonprofit there that does a lot of these cases, had found that courts had capped the fees that could be charged by defense attorneys to $1,000. You know, in recent years, you've seen that amount of money tick up, particularly as courts have realized that, or courts have decided that defendants are entitled to better expert witnesses, more investigation, more of this kind of mitigation investigation as was taking place in Nava's case.
Does the Mexican government offer assistance in any other kind of criminal cases involving nationals?
Not that I know of, though I don't want to speak completely, you know, 100% across the board on that. This is the sort of primary area where their involvement is pretty robust. And it kind of goes back to a sort of broader and deeper opposition to the death penalty in Mexico.
Any other countries do this, similar programs?
They do, or at least they have in the past. You know, there have been there are no formalized programs anymore from other countries because there simply are too few nationals from those countries facing the death penalty. But for a handful of years in the 2000s, El Salvador had a similar program. And then you hear about, you know, in individual cases, Germany, England, other European countries getting involved in one way or another in the defense of nationals from their countries.
We're talking with Maurice Chama of the Marshall Project about Mexico's Capital Legal Assistance Program. That's a program that helps to track and also to assist cases of Mexican nationals charged with capital crimes in the United States and also to assist their legal teams. So in the case of Mr. Campos Navo, the assistance helped to keep him off of death row. Has it been successful in keeping other convicted murderers off of death row?
It has. It can be difficult to kind of get data on the program because, you know, it's run by the Mexican government, and then it is actually implemented by American lawyers. And both those parties are fairly sort of closed-mouthed when it comes to kind of discussing their work and putting their work out there in the media because, you know, they understand, particularly in this presidential season, that the relationship between Mexico and the U.S., while stable, has all sorts of tensions around immigration, and they, I think, are sensitive to the idea that they might be accused of sort of meddling in the American criminal justice system. But that said, there was a 2008 article by the head of the program, who was an attorney in Tucson, Arizona, named Greg Kirkendall, and at the time he claimed that their records showed that they had a 95% success rate in keeping about 300 Mexican nationals from being executed. Now, that's not all keeping them from being sent to death row in the first place. And in some cases, you'll have, you know, an older case maybe from the 80s and 90s where a Mexican national was sent to death row and the Mexican government was not aware of it. But once they became aware, they started getting involved with that defendant's appeals. So, you know, contesting all sorts of aspects of the case that would sort of stave off an execution. There have been a handful of specific instances where Mexican nationals were executed, often against the sort of strenuous opposition of the Mexican government. There's a handful of sort of big famous cases like that. A former president of Mexico refused a visit to George W. Bush's ranch in Crawford after one of these executions. So it's been kind of a source of tension between the two countries. But overall, it is sort of very clear that the program has kind of had an immense effect in terms of keeping Mexican nationals off death row in the U.S.
We here in the U.S. often hear about deplorable conditions for Americans who've been imprisoned abroad, of course, depending on the country. But do other countries look at American penitentiaries and sentencing in an equally bad light?
They definitely do, yeah. I mean, the death penalty is a kind of symbol of punitiveness and a symbol of a kind of very harsh way of handling crime that many European countries and then also many non-European countries like Mexico see as kind of a illustrative of a kind of a particularly brutal American justice system. You constantly hear in Europe sort of criticisms of the American criminal justice system, that it's barbaric, that it's overly harsh. A lot of Europeans have become particularly concerned about solitary confinement. They think that it's torture, and they think that it kind of puts the U.S. in league with countries like China and Saudi Arabia and Iran that have sort of checkered human rights reputations. And, you know, the criminal justice system is one area, and the death penalty in particular is an area where sort of international norms kind of put the United States more in a category with these other countries, again, China, India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, than with sort of its Western European peers.
Maurice, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Maurice Chama, staff writer for the Marshall Project. You'll find a link to read his article, How Mexico Saves Its Citizens from the Death Penalty in the United States, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. About two-thirds of New Yorkers are from immigrant families. No matter where parents come from, children born here are American children, which leaves families challenged to choose which native practices to retain and which new norms to follow. That was the case for radio rookie Andrea Lee Torres's family. Her parents arrived from the Philippines in the 1990s. Here, she questions one of their decisions, not to teach her their language.
I'm in the car with my parents. I drift away into the back seat as the car muffles out their words. But this is how I always hear them. They're speaking my family's dialect, Kamapangan, also known as breastfed language. My parents never fed it to me. My older sister Sarah was born in the Philippines, and they speak to her in Kamapangan, but I was born in America, and they speak to me in English. Why? Excuse number one.
You were about a year, and you don't really like talk. So I asked the doctor why. And she said, what language do you speak at home? And then she said, oh, probably she's confused.
So it's the doctor's fault. Here comes excuse number two.
If you were speaking Tagalog and you never learn how to speak English when you go to school, it's very hard for you to adjust.
And lastly, excuse number three.
Probably you're not really interested in learning how to speak.
My mom says I probably whined.
I don't need it.
So it was my fault? But seriously, none of these excuses change the fact that I'm Filipino and I don't know my own language. I can't call the Philippines my home like the rest of my family. I do like my fatty roasted pig and a sugary iced halo-halo. And when I get off the plane in Manila, I love the smell, the way it fills my lungs. But then, we open the front gate of my family's home and they gather around my sister, talking, laughing, sharing stories of how they raised her until she was three. When they get to me, I feel like they don't know my name, and I don't know theirs.
You get frustrated, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't understand it. We were all laughing, and you just be in the middle of it, looking at us, right?
I'm a joke to them. Even my sister Sarah laughs.
I don't know, you don't find it funny? Because I find it funny, that's what I think.
Haha, yeah, okay. It's like being tickled after it's not fun anymore.
Okay.
So last year, I decided to learn the language, get some flip pride. Flip, short for Filipino.
Teaching myself Tagalog through this book called Teach Yourself Tagalog. All right.
My mom convinced me to learn a national language instead of their dialect because it's more practical. But she doesn't have faith in me and my shiny Tagalog CD and book.
Do you open it and read it?
I don't have time to.
Oh, see? Oh. If you want to learn, you just read or you watch the Filipino channel.
But I don't understand.
Well, you will learn.
Sometimes when we see other parents, when their children speak Filipino, something like that, we're just a little bit envious that our children, they cannot do that.
I feel like a huge letdown.
Hello?
That's when I call my cousin in California to rant. How do you feel about Filipino-Americans who always say Filipino pride, flip pride, Pinoy pride? How do you feel about that?
That's their problem. What are we proud of? Corruption?
Ace grew up hating his Filipino-ness.
They have a lack of being able to cultivate their minds, mainly only viewing inane television programs. I don't know any successful Filipino business owners. I don't know. From personal experience, I've known many criminals.
So, Ace, for someone like me who feels disconnected from the Filipino culture, what advice can you give me?
Remain that way.
Dot. Dot. Dot.
This is when I should shove him and say, don't be like that. There's a lot to be proud of, but I can't. I don't know enough. So Ace, I have to go now.
Okay.
We're like loud Americans with cheeseburgers in our hands.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Hi.
Professor Agnes Magdoto teaches Tagalog at NYU. She says that most of the people she teaches are Filipino Americans, like me.
Why Tagalog? Why Filipino language? It's basically to be able to reconnect with my roots.
But she also says it takes more than language to reconnect.
I think identity is not defined by the language you speak.
When I was talking to my cousin, he actually brought up a conflict in me, thinking that I'm not really that proud of being a Filipino. And just meeting you and you telling me about your classes, and it just made it seem like maybe I can do this and maybe I can tell them to be a little bit more proud and think about it.
You know what's great? Your cousin pushed you. He challenged you. There's so many uncomfortable things happening in our head, but it's okay.
Other than learning the language, what else do you recommend that I should do?
Enrich that learning. What else is there in history? What else is there in terms of your own family history?
The only time my parents talk to me about their lives is when I see a spider and I freak out. They laugh at me and say, "We used to play with spiders. Why are you so scared?" I don't really ask about their lives. Can you share some stories about your childhood?
When I was growing up, in the Philippines especially, you have many friends.
I finally got off my scaredy butt. And when I did, my dad talked about family and respect and how that runs in my blood.
You're part of it.
But he also told me about his hard times, something I've always wanted to listen to.
Sometimes to provide food, clothes, things was difficult for us because we were 9 children, so we always wear the same clothes. Wear it, clean it. So I just try to sacrifice.
Why didn't you teach us the value of sacrificing?
Why should we? Because we know the feeling to sacrifice. It's very, very hard. We don't want you to feel that too.
I asked my dad if all of this was the reason why they never spoke to me in their language. Honestly, I wanted him to say they faced hard times, moved on to America, dusted off the webs, and just put me on the English track. Then I'd understand. But he said that he wasn't turning away from his past, just thought I didn't need his culture.
We're not in the Philippines. You'll get frustrated if we push you to speak Tagalog in America. And we're very proud of you that you could speak English very well.
Because I'm American.
Because you're in America.
My sister Sarah knows English and Kamapangan. But my parents say Sarah had a hard time making friends when she came here at 3 and only knew Filipino.
When I'm here, I feel very Filipino. But if I go back there to the Philippines, I'm American. It's this very in the middle type thing. You get stuck in the middle. That's where I am.
I guess I can see why my parents didn't want to make me Filipino. They wanted to give me a place to fit in. Okay, I fit in.
So right now I'm gonna re-begin. how to understand and read words.
Maybe my dad was right. I don't need his culture, but I want it.
So let's be in chapter one.
And that story was produced by Sandra Tai and Marianne McCune for Radio Rookies.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 16 years in, the 21st century is an awkward adolescent, about the age of Molly Ringwald's character in Pretty in Pink, director John Hughes' movie about a girl from the wrong side of the tracks who falls for a rich classmate.
Why haven't you called me?
Oh, I got nailed for the stable thing. I guess the groom's knows it's against club rules.
I called you 3 times and I left messages.
Yeah? Well, I didn't get them. My family, they're very responsible about that stuff, you know?
That movie is now 30 years old, one of the teen-centric 80s movies adored by people who may now have teenage kids of their own. Kevin Smokler makes the case that movies like Back to the Future, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Breakfast Club, and other big-haired classics represented the first time that teenagers were portrayed as human beings. And though dated by side ponytails and acid-wash jeans, they belong in the American film canon. His new book is called Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. And Kevin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me, Virginia. This is great.
Well, I've seen these YouTube mashups of 80s teen movies. Now, I'm wondering, like, why would they hold a place today for kids who have no idea what it's like to call someone on a rotary phone and have your family not give you the message?
Oh, you know, I think that stuff is quickly overlooked by the fact that the 80s teen movie largely seems to be relatable but not realistic. I think if these movies felt like documentaries of what it was like to be a teen in 1984, they would feel very dated. But instead, they feel like fables and myths about what it was like to be a teen 30 years ago. And consequently, you can graft your own experience if you're a teenager of today on top of that. And of course, all of that has gotten a helping hand from movies like Pitch Perfect, which contains essentially a 20-minute encomium to The Breakfast Club right in the middle of it.
Well, so you hop into the DeLorean in this book and bring us back to what was going on in the 80s. What was it that was making teen movies so successful?
Oh, there were a lot of things, starting most obviously with a generation of directors who, while not teenagers themselves, were interested in telling stories about young people. And that's most obviously John Hughes, but also Amy Heckerling and Martha Coolidge and Cameron Crowe and Savage Steve Holland. Also, you had the biggest boom of teenagers in the workplace since World War II. So that meant a lot of teenagers with disposable income and a lot of teenagers gathering in the places they worked, like shopping malls and record and video stores, and of course, movie theaters, as we see in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And we also had, at the exact same time, an explosion of ways to consume popular culture and media, from cable television to video games to VCRs and related home video. It was really the beginning of the teen consumer. I wouldn't say at the beginning. The 60s was more the beginning of the teen consumer. This was the epigee of the teenager as a mass market. And of course, that came with entertainment directed at teenagers.
And it was also the apex or nadir, depending on who you ask, of the suburbs. And locations are a very important thing for you. You kind of lock into why these movies, often placed in a kind of suburban anywhere USA, are not just backdrops, but also kind of a supporting character. Why is location so important?
Well, the obvious answer is this is the last generation of movies about teens before the internet comes along, before the internet and mobile phones sort of upend our very notion of location. And while I would argue that the teen movies that came in the next decade, your Cluelesses and your 10 Things I Hate About You, Clueless is a better movie because of how it uses Los Angeles, and 10 Things is far more interesting because of how it uses Seattle. But I think in those cases, geography is kind of incidental to what makes the movie special. On the other hand, can you imagine Ferris Bueller's Day Off without the German Day Parade in downtown Chicago, or Breaking Away without Bloomington? Part of the testament to the permanence and the endurance of the 80s teen movie seems to be how rooted it is to places that still exist.
Well, we definitely have to talk about John Hughes and Shermer, Illinois. Yeah. But you raise a great point in here that he was making movies when the cities were these kind of dens of iniquity, you know, a place to escape to. But, you know, not like it wasn't until the 90s that we had Starbucks and yoga studios and loft apartments. The suburbs were safety in some way.
That's certainly how they were portrayed in these movies, at least in the sort of more mainstream John Hughes-powered versions of these movies. The darker, more dystopic versions of these movies, like Over the Edge and Heathers, portrayed the suburbs as kind of a kind of sterile hell, which is not a point of view unique to the 1980s, but one that was used to sort of skew the teen drama and black comedy of those movies. Yeah, the 80s are the height of the suburbs and just before new urbanization begins. You know, in another 5 years, like you said, you have Starbucks and yoga studios and people moving back into the cities. And nowadays you get a movie like Perks of Being a Wallflower, which ends with a triumphant shot of the three main characters driving into Pittsburgh. Set that movie in 1983, they would have been driving out of Pittsburgh as fast as their car could take them.
Well, John Hughes, of course, is one of the people that we remember. And since he died, five, 6 years ago?
Yes.
So many people have been thinking about and paying tribute to him in the years since. But he grew up also in the suburbs, but he grew up in Grosse Pointe, which is, I guess, north of Detroit. But his house was a little smaller than the other people's on the block. So there's this kind of feeling of inferiority. How do you think he was working that out in his movies?
The two movies that John Hughes scripted and didn't direct, Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful, both deal explicitly with class. We see a little bit of that beginning in The Breakfast Club, which he did write and direct as well. So John Hughes grows up a middle-class kid in an upper-middle-class town, and the tensions between kids of different classes and what it meant to not feel to feel judged because of where you came from is certainly part of the drama of his movies. It comes out a lot more in the movies, in the teen movies of this time that are self-consciously set in Los Angeles. So that would be your Valley Girls and your Karate Kids and your the Decline of Western Civilization documentaries, as well as Suburbia. All of those movies deal explicitly with kids on the wrong side of a class divide. In the book, I try to argue that that has something to do with Los Angeles's attitude towards itself at that time.
Let's play just a clip from The Breakfast Club. Here, clearly, Judd Nelson, who's the greaser? I can't remember.
The criminal.
Johnny Bender, I think, was his name, is clearly up against something.
Well, I'll just run right out and join the wrestling team. Maybe the prep club, too. Student council.
Nah, they wouldn't take you.
I'm hurt.
You know why guys like you knock everything?
Oh, this should be stunning.
Because you're afraid.
Oh, God, you Richies are so smart. That's exactly why I'm not heavy in activities.
You're a big coward.
I'm in a math club.
So you're afraid that they won't take you. You don't belong, so you just have to dump all over it.
Well, wouldn't have anything to do with you activities people being assholes now, would it?
Well, you would know. You don't even know any of us.
So the Richies...
Did you just say I'm in the physics club to yourself? That's the next one.
You did, because you've seen it like 55 times.
At least, yeah.
I have not. But it is interesting. You know, you get the Richies, as he said in there. Some conflict. Do you think that's reflective of what was happening across America at that time? This is the Reagan go-go 80s.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think any more or less than now. In fact, I would say economic inequality is probably worse now than it was in the 1980s. I'm not an economist. I don't know the answer to that. I just know it was of concern to John Hughes and frankly many of his contemporaries too, but it is only one theme that runs through the 80s teen movie.
We're speaking with Kevin Smokler. He's a big fan of 80s movies and an author of a new book called Brat Pack America, Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. So, yes, class was a part of the issue there, but there was a real lack of racial diversity in his films. Did that reflect what was happening in suburban America, or was Hughes just using a kind of microscope to represent the wider teen experience?
I don't think the wider teen experience was all that interesting to John Hughes. The genius of John Hughes, and also the difficulty of watching him today, is that he did get at a universal teen experience, but through a very, very small lens, a very small geographic lens with only kids that are largely white and upper middle class. There's a few working class kids in his movies, but largely a white upper middle class generation of young people. I think we can point to that and say that might have been a shortcoming of many of those movies. I also think we can say that those movies pried open the door for a greater, deeper, more compassionate look at youth culture in the United States. And that led naturally towards what happened the next decade with movies like Mi Vida Loca and Boys in the Hood and Set It Off, which are all movies about the youth experience of people of color in this country that are painted with the same degree of sensitivity and depth and compassion as the John Hughes movies of the previous decade.
Well, The Breakfast Club was meant to be taking place in Shermer, Illinois, on one particular Saturday of detention. You mentioned
March 24th, 1984.
You're so good at this.
No, it's funny because that's actually an inside joke. That was the week the movie began principal photography, so that's why they put that in the script.
You mentioned that the movie critic and longtime Chicago resident Roger Ebert called Chicago the teenage Hollywood. But it was actually this fictional suburban town of Shermer, Illinois, that almost universally was understood by teens, even those who had never been to Illinois.
Yeah, I spoke to a bunch of people from this book who were from not the north suburbs of Chicago, people who were from the south suburbs, a different side of Chicago, people who had never even been to Chicago when they saw these movies. And yet somehow this experience spoke to them, somehow this setting and the drama that happened there spoke to them. I think Shermer has become such a stand-in for the backdrop of the 80s teen movie, the same way Brat Pack, those two words together, now means 80s teen movie. It's so much a part of movie culture now that, for example, in John Hughes's biography, they had to spend all of like page 14 explaining that Shermer doesn't really exist. There was an anecdote I had to cut out of the book where a friend of mine from college decided to take his daughter to see Shermer, which doesn't exist, and he didn't know it. So he put Shermer into his rental car GPS, and he ended up on Shermer Road in Des Plaines looking at a cemetery and a housing development. And
wow.
His daughter was like, so? The fact that we have been contending in pop culture with whether Shermer, Illinois actually exists just tells me how complete a universe that John Hughes created in really only three or four teen movies.
Of course, John Hughes, as you point out, was not the only great director of that time. But
no.
Movie fans from the 80s, they gravitate towards different places where, like, where was the Back to the Future shot? You know, can we go to Ridgemont High? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
why do you think movie fans really gravitate towards these old locations that were just thrown off?
When you go to a movie location, for example, for the 25th anniversary of Back to the Future, they showed it in the parking lot of the Puente Hills Mall, which, of course, is where the DeLorean, you know, hit 88 miles an hour and actually went back to the future, or back to the past in that case. They showed the 25th anniversary there because the location itself has emotional power. When you make a pilgrimage to the location of where your favorite movie was filmed, you are not only collapsing time, i.e. you are going back to the historical moment when you saw that movie and it was made, you're also collapsing memory. You are remembering the first time you saw that movie, and you are stepping into a dream. You are stepping into, for a moment, a beloved movie. And if you love that movie enough to visit its locations, and people don't visit locations of movies they hate or feel lukewarm about, the dreams of that movie are probably yours too. A movie exhibitor I interviewed actually said there are certain kinds of movie fans in the world who, when you say, let's watch 2001 on the Moon, say, sign me up. And there are others that say, oh, it's just a movie, who cares? I think the people who love movies deep down in their heart recognize the emotional power of where movies happen.
Well, I think you are one of the former, is my guest, Kevin Smokler.
Sure am.
You know, you did make pilgrimages to some of these locations, but you also point out the danger of nostalgia. You know, this kind of idea that, oh, things were so much better then. But now I look back at these movies and their characters with the kind of affection that a lot of people don't seem to have for teenagers today. So which movies do you think will define the teenagers of today? And how does that sense of nostalgia just tie into all this?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, there are great teen movies being made today. Dope, Perks of Being a Wallflower, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, the recently released Edge of 17, like Sing Street, which I just saw. I mean, there are great teen movies being made today. Which ones will endure throughout the ages? I don't know. I don't think we knew that about The Breakfast Club or Real Genius or Dirty Dancing at the time either. If what you're asking is, will one of these movies be as beloved by not only teenagers but adults? Of course it will. We just don't know what it is yet. Just like we didn't know it was going to be The Karate Kid or Dead Poets Society when those movies came out. But something will. And this may sound like a self-serving argument, but I think one of the reasons for that is the teen movies today are the nieces and nephews and grandnieces and grandnephews of the movies in this book. They have that DNA. They have the DNA of teen movies that have endured for the last 30 years. And so I believe some of them will too.
Well, Kevin, thank you for speaking with us. You've renewed a spark for 80s teen movies for me.
Oh, I sure hope so. That's why I wrote the book in the first place. Thanks for having me.
Kevin Smokler, he's author of the essay collection Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School, and his new book, Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. There's a link to find more information on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gravity does burn inside me. I would orbit all who invite me. And that is Esperanza Spalding, the musical prodigy originally from Portland, Oregon. Now 5 albums into her career, she's won 4 Grammys, including Best New Artist in 2011, which dramatically disappointed Justin Bieber fans will never forget. She was also the first jazz artist ever to win that award. She'll be playing songs from her newest album, Emily's D+ Evolution, this Saturday at the Lebanon Opera House. Producer Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with Esperanza before her upcoming show about the album's mashup of funk, art rock, and jazz, which is the focus of the live show.
Yeah, it's not going to sound like McCoy Tyner. You know, it's not going to be swinging, quote unquote. The spirit of jazz is definitely in it, though. It is coming from a jazz aesthetic, but it doesn't sound like a jazz record. It sounds like Emily's music. I didn't have the word play or performance piece in mind, but they needed to be alive. They needed to move. And I knew from the beginning, this is like the one word that I did know at the beginning, that it was going to be staged. So what we're going to be bringing there is the fruits of about 2 years of experimenting with that and figuring out what that means and how to make it work and make it clear and make it feel like a journey that you can sit back and follow the music through.
Can you kind of talk about where the character came from or what the inspiration is behind it?
I don't know where the character came from. But I think what she invites the people she meets to experience, I suppose, is like if someone develops a character for a play. You understand what they are going to go through in the play, and you want to understand what would implore them to react in that way to the circumstances that they meet. And being her and exploring her concept of D+ evolution, what I've learned, just like what you can learn from a play, has affected my life. You know, it's shown me truth. It's shown me possibilities that are applicable beyond the stage. Oh, the moment I saw you, I knew we've both been looking for this. like I don't know if we talked about this yet, but it's been like a constantly changing project and process from the beginning in early 2014. And actually, I need to ask myself those questions constantly too, you know, like, what is she saying? Why? What is it about? What is she here for? It helps to kind of put priorities in order, you know, and make sure that I can communicate to myself in succinct answers what it is and what it is not and why. Because, as I'm sure you know, inspiration is a very diffuse medium. You know, it does not come in highly focused sentences.
We want to knock and climb brass rings of wisdoms and build our own hot breath kingdoms and make fuming passions rain down ash and hand out dirty white rules to wipe up and memorize and howl our own law hand-me-downs upon the class of masses and grin as each graduate passes on our synthesized words that sterilize natural awe.
Seeds grows on the mountain. You can dig it with a silver spoon.
It's been 10 years since your debut album, and with Grammy Awards, White House visits, is this pretty much how you expected things to go down when you started?
I've been doing music. I've been playing with music since I was a kiddie. I liked my compositions, even when I was really young. Like I had the audacity, whatever it is, to want to play them for people. My mom actually told me this story recently. I don't remember this, and I hope she's not exaggerating, but apparently when I was 5 or 6, I was in this music program for violin, but we had our, like, annual recital, and I wanted to play this little piano composition that I wrote instead of playing something on violin. So I allowed it, and she said, right before I went on stage, I got really scared and really nervous. And thought, like, oh my God, this is so stupid. Like, everybody else is playing Mozart and Bach and et cetera. And why am I doing this? And she said, but I decided that I still wanted to go out and play. And she said, I went up and I was shaking and she could see tears in my eyes, but I still, like, sat down and I played my little compositions for everybody. But I think in that, there's something about, like, is this all how I thought it would go? It all feels a lot like that still.
Mm.
Thinking something is a really good idea, I mean, when you're at home and you're writing it, and then realizing that all of a sudden you're doing it in front of other people and you don't know why or how, and you don't know if it's going to work, et cetera, et cetera. So, to answer your question, that's when I feel like I started out, you know, not 10 years ago. That album, when I made it, to move how it moved, it was very unexpected. And since then, I do my best to move my ideas forward and have them grow first from the content and then hopefully in their reach. I still don't know how it's going to play out. I just know it's going to be awesome and broader and more focused and refined, and it's really exciting.
That was producer Jimmy Gutierrez speaking with Esperanza Spalding. You can see her perform this Saturday, October 15th, at the Lebanon Opera House. There's more at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for listening today. Besides Esperanza Spalding, music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Yay Yay, and Paddington Bear. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.